Welcome to a special edition of Path to Zero, the podcast about clean energy and the journey toward a low-carbon future. We've traveled to New York City to take part in Climate Week conversations. Now, here's your host, Tucker Perkins.
Sometimes the term thought leader is thrown out just a bit too loosely. But my guest for this episode of Path to Zero is an energy and environmental thought leader in the truest sense of the term. Amy Myers Jaffe is an energy consultant and leading expert on the geopolitics of oil, energy, security, and risk. She's currently serving as a director of the Energy, Climate Justice, and Sustainability Lab and a research professor at NYU's School of Professional Studies. She also wrote the book, Energy's Digital Future, and is a regular on one of my favorite podcasts, The Energy Gang. Amy, it's just wonderful to have you with us today. Thanks for joining us on Path to Zero.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, we have so much to talk about today, but I want to start by giving you a chance to talk about kind of your work at the NYU Energy, Climate Justice, and Sustainability Lab.
Well, our idea for the lab is to really help bring important issues to the fore through thought leadership, but also using new technology. You know, NYU is very famous for its film and gaming school, and also we're very good with blockchain and social media. So we're going to try to use a number of different platforms, including the metaverse, to try to help people understand that there is a really great path forward to decarbonization, to addressing climate change, and that that pathway doesn't have to be a negative thing. It can be a positive thing with, you know, fun and interesting technologies that are going to be more resilient to weather than the technologies we have today, and really help people understand what our options are and how we could clear the way to make them accelerate.
You've written quite a bit of work, and we're going to talk about a couple pieces today, but you have a fascinating book, Energy's Digital Future. What is the overall thesis? How did it come about? Maybe important conclusions from that book.
Well, you know, I spent 5 years out in California, a lot of interaction with inventors and business people from Silicon Valley. And I was really struck with the number of innovations that were coming down the road that could have really positive impact on our energy system, whether it's to make it more resilient to weather or whether it's to make it lower carbon. But to have all of those technologies be a positive outcome was going to take guardrails from policymakers. And so that was sort of the thinking behind the book was to, it originally started with a task force that involved a lot of, you know, prominent names in Silicon Valley. You know, we had members from Google and from Apple and different technology companies, a big drone company, to try to think about how these technologies would shape the energy system going forward. And that led to, you know, a big tour of Silicon Valley, you know, sort of seeing firsthand, you know, robot taxis and, you know, some of the things that I think are still to come. And then, you know, hence I then put it together in a book for readers. And my new ambition is to be able to have you touch and feel those technologies in the metaverse with your own avatar so that it becomes real to you and you can really picture what life is going to be like in 2050 when a lot of these technologies take hold more than they have today.
You know, the subtitle really jumped out at me. I think the subtitle, Harnessing Innovation for American Resilience and National Security. Will you kind of walk through that subtitle and maybe how digital technology ties into both resilience and national security? Two very different things, but both extremely important.
Well, I have to take readers back in time because I wrote the book before the Inflation Reduction Act, and I was very concerned that we had no industrial policy in this country. We weren't emphasizing our competitive landscape for manufacturing and leading in many of these technologies. especially because China had such a giant program to overtake the United States in everything from self-driving, where we had an edge, to virtual power plant, where, you know, Tesla and SUP for solar were some of the big first movers in matching batteries with solar in a way that would bring resilience to places that were already having brownouts and blackouts. So my goal was to really focus policymakers on how to keep the United States competitive in the future products, and not just in, you know, having people focus on this, you know, energy dominance that we're a major exporter of oil and gas, but to really look forward and see that we've also hit the jackpot with a lot of these technologies that were digital coming down the road, and we needed to not let ourselves get overtaken. You know, years ago, people forget, we spent a lot of money in the 70s and 80s on solar technology. Then we dropped out of that. We still had in the 90s, we were, you know, most of the companies in the top 10 solar. But then China made a huge program in the 2000s and completely overtook the industry internationally. So my goal with the book was to really help people see that we need to step it up, that we couldn't rest on our laurels, that we needed to have a policy-driven incentive to have digital be applied to climate solutions, and also national security, that we need to protect our advances through government-funded R&D, but also just in import controls and export controls related to these very sensitive technologies. Because we might think about a company in Silicon Valley and actually GM, you know, testing self-driving taxi cabs in San Francisco, and we're worried about whether they're going to hit a pedestrian or not. But the truth is that technology is a fundamentally dual-purpose technology. What do I mean by that? It is going to be first in class for how the future of war is going to transpire. And the United States, I mean, you know, the analogy I make in the book and in talking about the book is it would be kind of like the Sputnik moment, you know, where the United States realized that the Soviets had a satellite in space and we didn't. At that moment, we started, you know, the mission to space. And people don't realize this. You know, they use GPS in their everyday life. And, you know, where would we be without GPS? No one can read a map anymore. But GPS was a technology that was developed by the Pentagon and the science community to track the Sputnik satellite. And if you imagine a world where the United States was not having satellites, and the Soviet Union or now Russia and China had satellites, you can imagine how our national security would be threatened. And so that's how it is with all of these digital technologies, whether it's defending in cyberspace our electricity networks, whether it's having automated vehicles and having an edge on those kind of technologies, having secure energy. All of these things are important for national security.
Really interesting. And so when you talk about digital techniques, just for our listeners, you've talked about a few. I mean, you talk about autonomous vehicles to a degree, but it really spans the gamut of things that make operations more efficient, better information flow, autonomous vehicles. Is just, you want to elaborate on anything that maybe I didn't talk about?
Yeah. So for example, one of the things that's coming that could, again, give us very much more resilience, whether that's in manufacturing or whether that's in our electricity system or other kinds of systems, you know, the combination of artificial intelligence and big data is extremely powerful. So, you know, we can have predicted analytics. So we know that when a wire is going to get too hot, we avoid having some problem with overload of the electricity system. We can do predictive analytics so that we know how much backup power we're going to need, or we can know how much we can actually, you know, During the California heat wave a year ago, you know, California sent out a text message to everybody in California telling them what to turn their thermostat to and, you know, what electricity products to try to avoid for a period of time. But, you know, we could come to a day where you're going to sign a contract with your utility and they're literally, while you're at work, they're going to be able to turn all those things off for the period of time to make sure we don't have a brownout and then turn them back on for you. So by the time you get home, your home is cooled again or your car is charged or whatever. And you know, some of this is going to be extremely seamless and very workable. But it has to be secure. And we need to know and be educated as to what it means when we opt into these programs.
It's kind of an exciting future. I want to back up because your program is energy, climate justice, and sustainability. That's the three tentacles in the lab. Talk to us a little bit about your efforts around climate justice.
So our first effort on climate justice is focused on helping underserved communities prepare for climate adaptation and emergency response. You know, one of the problems we have in this country is that communities and the grid and so forth are not prepared for what's coming. A lot of communities have great infrastructure for flooding, say, because they've experienced that, but they have no infrastructure for how to deal with a heat wave. Which can be equally lethal. And so we have a program. It's in a joint venture with the Red Cross under funding from NASA to do sort of like climate presentations or information for already hard hit communities. When we then also go in and analyze the emergency procedures that they already have in place and the policies they've already put in place, you know, whether that's responses, infrastructure responses to flooding, or whether that's they've already put in cooling centers. But our emphasis is really on the justice element. So when you have wildfires, I won't mention the location, but if you have wildfires in a particular location, are your warning messages in English, but not in other languages? Are you providing services for people who live in wealthy communities, but those services are more lacking in communities that are low-income communities? Are they more greatly affected by existing infrastructure, and what are you doing about that? You know, one of the things that people have studied in the Houston Ship Channel is that the storage tanks are not made to the level of storms that are going to be expected in the future, and so therefore some of these low-income communities that have suffered the harm from facilities in the first place might be subject to damage to these storage tanks. And then that's going to come out into the water that's in floodwaters. And, you know, having lived in Houston for many years, I can tell you people don't understand how dangerous that is because, you know, sometimes when it's flooding, you know, people take a kayak and go out for the fun of it. That's one thing if you're going out in a boat because you're trying to rescue your neighbors. But recreationally, you know, you need to avoid floodwaters because they do have so many toxic materials in them, right? And the same thing about keeping yourself safe from smoke from wildfires, especially when they come to people's urban communities, you know, places where people live, because people have so many different kinds of materials in their garage or in the, you know, in storage facilities of industrial areas. So helping the communities understand what their risks are, have them see what policies they already have in place that are working, have them see what other communities have done with policies they haven't put in place yet. We think that's a very important activity to really help make sure that we're keeping our communities safe in the face, and then having them understand, as we've been discussing already, you know, what are the new technologies coming? You know, I'm going to be talking to a rural cooperative group in October about what kind of systems they should be putting in their investments going forward. And, you know, that's a strong consideration. We have to look at their future cooling load and possible heating load in the winter. You have to look at whether, you know, a lot of times there's this knee-jerk reaction that we have to stay with the existing technology, but, you know, maybe solar and battery storage in everybody's home could be safer and more resilient than having a new thermal natural gas plant with carbon sequestration. You know, it depends on the location and availability.
Yeah, really, really nice answer. And I was going to ask you about how localized it was to New York, but I think in your answer, you showed you're really certainly national and in many cases multinational in that view. Well done. Speaking of speaking, you said you're going to be speaking to an electric co-op. You're also speaking here at Climate Week this week. What will you be talking about here at Climate Week?
Well, yesterday I talked about the challenges for corporations. You know, today you've got a lot of pledges to net zero. Now you've got regulators and others coming in and scrutinizing that and asking corporate leaders whether they are greenwashing or whether they're serious about the things that they have set down on paper they intend to do. And I talked a little bit about the implementation challenge, how to get everybody in the organization to row in the same direction. And some of that has to do with compensation structure. Some of that has to do with engagement across the company in terms of common values and goals. And I was there with two corporate leaders, the head of sustainability for PepsiCo, and also the energy company, Engie.
Good. Really nice. You know, I loved an article that you penned in the July Journal, Wall Street Journal, five things keeping us from going all electric. You know, I've been talking about a wide path for a long, long time. I don't really like the words all of the above, because I certainly think it is not all of the above, but it are certain things that are both climate friendly and health friendly and affordable, but yet meet the demands of business and consumers and do it in a cost effective way. But would you just walk maybe for our listeners through kind of your thoughts in that article, the five things keeping us from going all electric?
Well, I think when we start talking about solutions, whether it's a solution to clean energy because you have air pollution in the community, or whether it's a solution because you want to limit carbon emissions, when we look at these issues, we have to look, what is the best in class solution? And if we start saying, no, every solution has to be electricity, you know, there are some sectors where electricity might not actually be the best solution. And there are some sectors where you're having chemical processes, whether that's in making steel from scratch, not necessarily scrap metal steel, because that you can do with electricity well. But, you know, there are just some chemical processes where the carbon comes out from the chemical process itself and not from the electrical or non-electrical energy that's used, say, for heat. So, and then of course, there's the challenge of airplanes. You know, we're not taking anytime soon an electric airplane across the Atlantic or Pacific Oceans, because the battery weight that it would take to do that would be, you know, even more than the plane itself. So in the article, I kind of walk through some of the interesting innovators that are out there coming out with different technologies to make trucking clean, or different technologies for aviation fuel, and also for heavy industry, and really, you know, argue that if we just, you know, limit ourselves ideologically to one solution as a one size fits all, we're not going to get the best, like you said, we're not going to get the best superior technology at the lowest cost. And, you know, first principles, what is the problem you're trying to solve, and what might be the best technology to solve that? And, you know, myself coming from the university setting, you know, I don't like someone dictating. If I've got a scientist doing something brilliant, that's not electrifying something, you know, I don't want his funding cut or her funding cut because of an ideology. I mean, it might be that there's some very promising technologies out there that could really solve the problem without electrification.
Yeah, really, really, it was a great article. I love to see it published because I thought it was so fair. All right, we're going to start to wind up.
And one of the things we love to do towards the end is to ask a really important question. It involves magic. We love to give you this magic wand that you can use one time for one thing in the next year. So all kinds of ones in there, one time, 1 year, but that you think, in your opinion, would have the most impact regarding climate change. How would you use that wand?
I think I would use that wand to create a global consensus for immediate action. So getting everyone aligned in a unified goal with a unified pathway where we recognize, like I've been talking about, that there are technologies we know we're going to work, We have a unified plan for how to fund those technologies in countries that can't access that funding themselves. And just like, I mean, we just don't have a commitment on the level that we need. We have vested interests and leaders with conflicting interests, and we're not getting to where we need to go. And I feel like the public is not the problem, right? I feel like the public, if they were presented with these understanding of these new technologies, they would be in favor of them. And really, we just need to take the ideology out of the debate. So I'm going to leave you with one last anecdotal story. I'm on the train a couple of weeks ago, and a elderly retired woman sits down next to me, and she starts, you know, sort of telling me her troubles. And, you know, I she seemed lonely. So I, you know, decided, okay, 45 minutes, I'm going to invest 45 minutes in this person. And anyway, after she talked about herself for a while, I guess she felt a little badly that she's not asking me any questions. So she asked me what I did. And I said, I was a university professor. And then she asked me, what did I study? And I said, climate change. And she corrected me and told me that there is no climate change. And I looked her dead in the eye and I said to her, when you turn on the television, I said, you watch the news, correct? She said, yes. I said, when you turn on the television and you see what happened in Pakistan with the floods and you see the fire in Hawaii and you see the heat wave and how it's affecting people here in the United States and in other countries, I said, what do you think? I said, how could you possibly not believe that that is partly having to do with climate change? And she pauses and she says, well, okay, you're right. Of course, that has to do with climate change. She says, I just don't think there's a solution to it. So then I talked to her about technology's role in our life, how she could engage with her grandchildren. She had had a negative experience with Airbnb. And so I talked about, you know, how her grandchildren, that could be something they could do in common where they could help her with technology. I talked to her about some of these energy technologies that were coming that she could have in her home to lower her electricity bill. And we really had a very positive conversation. She hugged me at the end of the train ride. And I just feel like that's representative. So if we could really, if I could just eliminate all of the misinformation and get people and politicians on this page that we're going to row the boat in the same direction, that, you know, these technologies that are coming down the pike are not negative technologies, they're positive technologies, and that we got to do this in a way that our lifestyle is going to be better for us and better for the planet both at the same time. I feel like we could really actually solve climate change in a way that would be very positive for everyone.
Yeah, I certainly agree. That's a great use of your wand. And I have to agree that if that would work, we could get to a consensus faster, invest better, reap benefits quicker. That's a lofty use of that wand, but I'm going to encourage you because I do think, and you see it at weeks like this when we're together, we're not at a consensus yet, sadly, around even the cause, much less the solutions. And this, I feel like today we're better than we were a year ago. The solutions seem to be a little bit more structured, a little bit more realistic, private and public monies coming together. But, you know, you don't have to wander very far on topics like carbon capture, nuclear power, hydrogen, before all of a sudden the eyes start rolling and the consensus is certainly muted for sure.
Right. And people get sort of stovepiped I'm a hydrogen person, so all I talk about is hydrogen, but hydrogen is not appropriate for every solution. And, you know, same thing with other technologies. They have their place, and we have to think about, I mean, the big thing I think we don't ever talk about is how to optimize the retiring infrastructure and the emerging infrastructure.
Absolutely.
We can't have two energy systems operating at arm's length and therefore causing volatility. We need to have systematic integration of existing infrastructure and new infrastructure with a plan for retirement in a way that brings us the best benefits.
And back to your original points, I mean, it all needs to be done in a digital environment. So move away from that analog style system we had. It has to be really state-of-the-art, digitalized.
Correct.
Because there's where we do get the efficiencies, for sure.
Right. And I tell people, last point before we sign off, I tell people, you know, if I came to you and told you I could bring you an analog telephone that you could plug in your house and your phone bill would go down and be guaranteed to be $25 forever, and that the United States was going to spend $1 billion putting telephone booths back in train stations and on street corners. You know, given the fact that the rest of the world is going to other kinds of technologies, would that help our economy? No.
Yeah.
Right? Because because these other technologies that are coming have superior elements. You know, when you have a smartphone, you're walking around with a computer. It does a lot more than just be a telephone.
Right.
And so that's kind of how we have to think about these digital technologies and their applications to energy and to equipment efficiency and to building efficiency. You know, we just have these unbelievably strong tools and we need to embrace them, but embrace them in a way that lowers carbon emissions and lowers pollution and you know, protects human safety.
Yes, well said. One last thing, we love to plant a tree in a national forest in honor of you and your time and your expertise, what you've shared with our listeners on Path to Zero. Is there a place that you would love to see a tree planted in your name?
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, you know, why don't you pick some place that's a urban desert, so to speak. So find me a neighborhood. Maybe I'm here in New York City. Find me a neighborhood in New York City where people, you know, don't have enough trees. We know that having too much pavement and not enough tree cover makes the impact of heat waves much, much worse. So find me a community, maybe downtown near NYU that doesn't have enough tree cover and put my tree there.
Interesting observation. We've been doing this podcast for nearly 3 years, and I don't know that we ever heard that. And over the last month, you may be at least the third person who has really acknowledged, you know, urban heat domes and how we need to do a change for walkable and livable cities. And so we will gladly honor that request. Amy Myers Jaffe, director of the Energy, Climate, Justice, and Sustainability Lab, research professor at NYU. How wonderful it has been to have you on Path to Zero. Thank you so much.
Hecker, it's been a pleasure to be talking to you.
Thank you for listening to a special edition of Path to Zero with Tucker Perkins from Climate Week in New York City. If you like what you've heard, subscribe and rate us on your favorite podcast app. You can email us with questions or comments to pathtozero@propane.com.